Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. I cannot believe it's almost August of 2025. Today is 29 July 2025. It's a Tuesday. And I know that administrative law is not necessarily something that make you get out of bed excited about in the morning, but I also want to tell you that this channel, the Republican Professor, will cover things that don't typically get covered. The most interesting and important things in American politics quite often do not get covered by any media and may entirely be off of your radar. And they happen in the realm of administrative law. And that's why we're going through the Chevron doctrine. This is some of the most important stuff happening in American politics. It's a level removed from actual cases, the theory, the jurisprudence, the political philosophy, the constitutional law, the statutory construction, so on and so forth, is different than you'll get in an individual case, like, for example, Sackett versus EPA, for example, if you wanted to chase something down. That's something that might not get covered, in any kind of detail. It might not be on your radar. But this is the most important stuff happening in American politics. And we're going to get into Loper Bright, the majority opinion written by Justice Gorsuch. Look at the syllabus, for God's sake. The syllabus is 8 pages long. It's almost as bad as remember that abortion case in 1992? Remember that one? It was like a plurality opinion, upheld Roe, but changed the reasoning of Roe. Remember that one? Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Oh, what a joy that was. Okay, if you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry about it. Opinion of the court, page one, Loper Bright versus Raimondo, Secretary of Commerce. You know what? Chief Justice Roberts delivered the opinion in court. Man, I got that wrong. I said Gorsuch. Roberts delivered the opinion of the court. Gorsuch's concurrence is one we'll get to here pretty soon as well. Let me pull up the case. All right. So I'm just going from the SupremeCourt.gov opinions. I'll link it in the description. Here's Chief Justice Roberts. Since our decision in Chevron, since our decision in Chevron, since our decision in Chevron, our decision in Chevron. Trying to get the lighting. All right. I got too many law review articles cluttering my desk. We have sometimes required courts to defer to permissible agency interpretations of statutes those agencies administer, even when a reviewing court reads the statute differently. In these cases, we consider whether that doctrine should be overruled. All right, if you want to know what I'm using for propping up the microphone, I had to pause it because my microphone was acting up. Using a reverse Chinese English dictionary. Very important to get one of these. I don't know how long they're going to make them, but I have a couple of them and I think they're very useful. If you know, you know. If you don't, well, okay. I guess I'm just wasting your time. I got mine at Yellow Brick Road in Carmel in the barnyard. If you know, you know. I'm on page one. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And here we go. Our Chevron doctrine requires courts to use a two-step. Next page. A two-step framework to interpret statutes administered by federal agencies. Right? Yeah. After determining that a case satisfies the various preconditions we have set for Chevron to apply, a reviewing court must first assess whether whether Congress has directly spoken to the precise issue, the precise question at issue. That's number one. If and only if congressional intent is clear, that is the end of the inquiry. But, and there's only one T, so don't get too excited, if the court determines that the statute is silent or ambiguous with respect to the specific issue at hand, the court must, at Chevron's second step, defer to the agency's interpretation if it is based on a permissible construction of the statute. That's number two. The reviewing courts in each of these cases before us applied Chevron's framework to resolve in favor of the government challenges to the same agency rule. All right, now we're at A. Looks like I should have. I'll give you a second to look at this. There's two steps there. Step one here, look where the cursor is. Step two here. We're on page two of the opinion of the court. And now we're on section A. Before 1976, unregulated foreign vessels dominated fishing in the international waters off the U.S. coast, which began just 12 nautical miles offshore. How many of you guys know that about 12 nautical miles? Yeah. How many of you guys have heard of the Hainan Island incident? Well, you could Google it if you want. The Chinese military claims that owns the entire South China Sea, but the rule in international law is 12 nautical miles, not 24, not 13, 12. And that didn't stop them from crashing into our airplane beyond 12 nautical miles off of their shore. But I'm not going to get into that. I'm sure you can read about it in open source material if you want. But yeah, 12 nautical miles is the zone there of sovereignty. Recognizing the resultant overfishing and the need for sound management of fishery resources, Congress enacted the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, MSA. The MSA and subsequent amendments extended the jurisdiction of the United States to 200 nautical miles beyond the U.S. territorial sea and claimed exclusive fishery management authority over all fish within that area, known as the Exclusive Economic Zone. The National Marine Fisheries Service administers the MSA under a delegation from the Secretary of Commerce. The MSA established the eight regional fishery management councils composed of representatives from the coastal states, fishery stakeholders, and NMFS. I'm on page three. The councils develop fishery management plans, which MFS approves and promulgates as final regulations. Go to page 3. In service of the statute's fishery conservation and management goals, the MSA requires that certain provisions, such as a mechanism for specifying annual catch limits at a level such that overfishing does not occur, be included in these plans. The plans may also include additional discretionary provisions. For example, plans may prohibit, limit, condition, or require the use of specified types and quantities of fishing gear, fishing vessels, or equipment. Reserve a portion of the allowable biological catch of the fishery for use in scientific research, and prescribe such other measurements, requirements, or conditions and restrictions as are determined to be necessary and appropriate for the conservation and management of the fishery. All right, you guys, this is nice background, I'm sure. Relevant here, a plan may also require that one or more observers be carried on board domestic vessels. Notice that they can't say anything about international vessels, but domestic vessels, for the purpose of collecting data necessary for the conservation and management of the fishery. The MSA specifies three groups that must cover costs associated with the observers. One, foreign fishing vessels operating within the exclusive economic zone, which must carry observers. Vessels participating in certain limited access privilege programs, which impose quotas permitting fishermen to harvest only specific quantities of a fishery's total allowable catch, and three, vessels within jurisdiction of the North Pacific Council, where many of the largest and most successful commercial fishing enterprises in the nation operate. In the latter two cases, scroll down, the MSA expressly caps the relevant fees at 2 or 3% of the value of fish harvested on the vessel. And in general, it authorizes, go to the next page. It authorizes the secretary to impose sanctions on when any payment required for observer services provided to or contracted by an owner or operator has not been paid. The MSA does not contain similar terms addressing whether Atlantic herring fishermen may be required to bear costs associated with any observers a plan may mandate. At one point, NMFS fully funded the observer coverage the New England Fishery Management Council required in its plan for the Atlantic herring fishery. In 2013, however, the council proposed amending its fishery management plans to empower it to require fishermen to pay for observers if federal funding became unavailable. Several years later, NMFS promulgated a rule approving the amendment. All right, this is what this is about this rule that the regulatory agency promulgated. With respect to the Atlantic herring fishery, the rule created an industry-funded program. Ah, there you go. That's it right there. An industry-funded program. So there's a private taking right there. Public taking for private taking for public use. that aims to ensure observer coverage on 50% of trips undertaken by vessels with certain types of permits. Under that program, vessel representatives must declare into a fishery before beginning a trip by notifying NMFS of the trip and announcing the species the vessels intend to harvest. If NMFS determines that an observer is required but declines to assign a government paid one, the vessel must contract with and pay for a government certified third party observer. NMFS estimated that the cost of such an observer would be up to 710 per day, reducing annual returns to the vessel owner by up to 20%. 20% tax right there. Are you guys following this? Does it make sense? So make a dollar. So if it makes a dollar, it makes 100 cents. All right. That's the sticking point right there. Petitioners, Loper Bright Enterprises, Inc., et cetera, are family businesses. Did you catch that? They're family businesses that operate in the Atlantic herring industry, fishery. In February of 2020, they challenged the rule under the MSA, they challenged the rule under MSA, which incorporates the Administrative Procedure Act. In the relevant part, they argued that the MSA does not, I'm going to the next page here. The MSA does not authorize NMFS to mandate that they pay for observers required by a fishery management plan. The district court granted summary judgment to the government. Okay, so those families lost. It concluded that the MSA authorized the rule, but noted that even if these petitioners' arguments were enough to raise an ambiguity in the statutory text, deference to the agency's interpretation would be warranted under Chevron. A divided panel of DC Circuit affirmed. The majority addressed various provisions of the MSA, concluded that it was not wholly unambiguous whether NMFS may require Atlantic herring fishermen to pay for observers. Because there remains some question as to Congress's intent, the court proceeded to Chevron's second step and deferred to the agency's interpretation as a reasonable construction of the MSA. In dissent, Judge Walker concluded that Congress's silence on industry-funded observers for the Atlantic herring fishery, coupled with the express provision for such observers in other fisheries and on foreign vessels, unambiguously indicated NMFS lacked the authority to require Atlantic herring fishermen to pay the wages of at-sea monitors. Well, let me. Where do I start here? The question is whether ambiguity exists. The question that the DC Circuit entertained. And you'll notice that Chevron deference created a systematic bias in favor of the government if the court happens to determine that, lo and behold, an ambiguity exists in the congressional text. What could possibly go wrong here? I'm asking you that. Tell me, What could possibly go wrong with this systematic, and it is systematic, bias in favor of the government? And you'll notice, won't you? Please notice with me that the dissenter in that DC Circuit panel was Walker. And Walker, of course, is Justin Walker, who was appointed by President Trump to replace, well, I think he replaced, must have replaced Brown, I think. I don't think he replaced Kavanaugh. I think Naomi Rao replaced Kavanaugh, but he did used to he used to clerk for Kavanaugh. He clerked for, I think, Kennedy as well. So this guy Walker says on the DC Circuit's judge, Trump judge, Republican, said that Congress's silence on this industry-funded observers, along with this express provision for observers and other fisheries and on foreign vessels, that's foreign vessels that come back to the United States, FYI, that go into that 12 nautical mile radius, unambiguously indicated that NMFS lacked the authority to require Atlantic herring fishermen to pay the wages of at-sea monitors. So he would say against the government. He would say that the regulatory agency does not have that power. We go to part C now. In Robert's opinion of the court on page five, his page five, petitioners relentless, this is the other, party here, et cetera, own two vessels that operate the Atlantic herring fishery, the FV Relentless and the FV Persistence. These vessels use small mesh bottom trawl gear and can freeze fish at sea so they can catch more species of fish and take longer trips than other vessels, about 10 to 14 days. Now, what would go wrong there? Well, if you have an observer and you're paying them daily, they can stay out longer, but that means they pay more, as opposed to the typical 2 to 4. Okay. As a result, they generally declare into multiple fisheries per trip so they can catch all whatever the ocean offers up. If the vessels declare into the Atlantic herring fishery for a particular trip, they must carry an observer for that trip if NMFS selects the trip for coverage, even if they end up harvesting fewer herring than other vessels or no herring at all. So they have to pay. The government says, you pay, you pay. This set of petitioners, like those in the DC Circuit case, filed a suit challenging the rule as unauthorized by the MSA. The district court, like the DC Circuit, deferred to the agency, NMFS, shocker, contrary to interpretation under Chevron, and thus grant a summary judgment to the government. Again, the First Circuit Court affirmed. It relied on a default norm that regulated entities must bear compliance costs, as well as the MSA sanction provision, and it rejected petitioner's argument that the express statutory authorization of three industry funding programs demonstrated that NMFS lacked the broad implicit authority it asserted to impose such a program for the Atlantic herring fishery. The court ultimately concluded that the agency's interpretation of its authority to require at-sea monitors who are paid for by the owners, this is what it's about. Money. The government is saying this needs to be paid for. And what do you know? They don't, the government doesn't want to pay for it. That's a shocker. You pay for it. The owners of regulated vessels. Court ultimately concluded that the agency's interpretation of its authority to require at-sea monitors who are paid for by owners of regulated vessels does not exceed the bounds of the permissible. Well, thank you very much for notice this language, the bounds of the permissible. This is a Orwellian language in the extreme here. I want you to take a good look at that. Does not exceed the bounds of the permissible. And how are you to know exactly what those bounds are? Is it some mystical thing that only judges have access to? That's not how our system is designed. It's not how it's supposed to function. The judges are not supposed to alone have access to the mythical land of the bounds of the permissible. That's what this case is about. It's about bureaucratic discretion. Let's keep going. Okay. In reaching that conclusion, the First Circuit stated that it was applying Chevron's two-step framework. But it did not explain which aspects of its analysis were relevant to which of Chevron's two steps. I have a thought about that, but let me finish this paragraph here. Similarly, it declined to decide whether the result was a product of Chevron step one or step two. What is my comment here? I have two comments. Right here, this is incredibly lazy for a federal court. Incredibly lazy. They're used to getting away with it, apparently. See, if you have a systematic bias in favor of the government, that produces eventually a lazy government, except when they're trying to get money out of you. But in all other respects, they're lazy as hell. And it creates a lazy court. The court is supposed to enforce the law using its judgment, which implies it is using some brain cells. It's got a couple brain cells to rub together. And it's using the canons of construction. It's doing its judicial duty. And that would imply that there's not a simple formula of the government wins. A systematic bias in favor of the government would make courts incredibly lazy. And that's exactly what you're seeing right here. What's interesting about this is that as a Chief Justice Roberts notes here, there's no circuit split. Did you catch that? The DC circuit just falls over and says, oh, the government wins. And the First Circuit, oh, the government wins. There's no circuit split. And Walker, the lone Republican judge on the DC circuit, who the lone Republican judge on that panel who said, no, the government doesn't automatically win. You gotta have a couple brain cells to rub together as judges, and you gotta get off the couch and put the potato chips away, turn off Oprah, stop phoning it in, and roll your sleeves up and do some frickin' judicial duty here. And that means sometimes you stand up for these families that are being crushed by government regulation, by bureaucrat discretion, not by something Congress said, although that happens, but by something that Congress didn't say. And so, therefore, a bureaucrat said, I'm going to say it instead. Since Congress didn't say it, I'm going to say it. And that bureaucrat did not stand for election and can't be fired. Wow. Wow, how convenient. That's what Chevron deference is about. That's why the Republicans, even though there was not a circuit split, finally were like, dude, we got to fix this. This is screwed up, man. Look at this disaster we have created. We got to go back to Congress makes the laws, not these regulatory agencies that have four letters now instead of three. And you get to the point where you don't even know which one this is. Is this 184th regulatory agency? How many regulatory agencies are writing law that don't stand for election? Congress is supposed to be writing law. Problem is the electorate wants Congress to do everything because they hear people running for office and the person running for office says, I can do anything for you. And they go, oh, okay. Because the electorate is stupid. And how did they get to be stupid? Because they went through K through 12, which makes them stupid. And it's not just K through 12. There's lots of great teachers out there. I got a great education in public school. It's that the parents aren't doing a good job either. I mean, parents these days, what are you doing with your kids in the phone? What is going on here? Kramer, what's going on here? And the culture is making them stupid. It's not just one answer. And the kids are choosing to be stupid. And professors are inflating grades in college. Democrat professors, not me. The Republican professor does not inflate grades. And this is all coming together along with social media, phones, low attention spans, and it spells disaster. You cannot expect the government, specifically Congress, to regulate the hell out of everything. They're going to punt on first down to some agency with four letters now, four or five letters. Now they're going to keep adding letters just like the alphabet people. Now they're adding plus signs and divide, and of course, they're really adding division. And empowering these faceless bureaucrats with the discretion to just say, yeah, we're going to take 20% all of a sudden. Republicans on the Supreme Court said, no more. No more. We granted cert. We granted cert. Chief Judge, Chief Justice said, in both cases, limited the question whether Chevron should be overruled or clarified. And that's it. We're in Roman numeral two now. Here's a teaser from Roman numeral two. You want to know, is this go under admin law or does it go under constitutional law? Well, Judge Brett Kavanaugh, when he was a judge on the DC Circuit Court of Appeals, he said that every case is a constitutional law case in the sense that every case is an Article 3 case. Every case is about separation of powers. Article 3 of the Constitution assigns to the federal judiciary the responsibility and power to adjudicate cases and controversies, concrete disputes with consequences for the parties involved. And by the way, the framers appreciated that the law judges would necessarily apply in resolving the laws judges would necessarily apply in resolving those disputes would not always be clear. There's There's work for the judges to do here, is what the Republicans on the Supreme Court are saying. And this is about separation of powers. Why? Because Article 3 makes it about separation of powers. We're going to take a look at whether Chief Justice John Roberts went far enough in this opinion. But we're not going to go further today. We're on page 7 of his. And we'll continue next time. Thank you for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. I've been your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. Today is Tuesday, 29 July, 2025, years after Jesus. We'll talk to you next time.